And welcome to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith, and I'm joined by
Jake Nguyen.
And I'm Sebastian.
And we have a jam-packed show for you today. It has been very busy. Now, for folks listening, you may not have been aware because I actually edited it out. But for the last 2 or 3 weeks, we have peppered all of our shows with an ongoing commentary about the situation happening in Chechnya, which is a semi-autonomous region in Russia. Now, for folks thinking, oh, what's happening in Chechnya? I mean, at this point, you should just Google Chechnya, and I'm pretty confident you'll find out what's been happening.
There's a lot going on.
So what we didn't, just to bring you up to speed, so that you know what we know, what we think we know, go back a couple of weeks, and we have a conversation about, you know, there's so much propaganda out of Russia that it's hard to see what's true and what isn't true. But multiple people have come forward and are claiming that gay men are being rounded up, arrested and tortured for the purpose of outing more gay men. It has been alleged by a UK politician that the president of Chechnya plans on eradicating gay men by Ramadan, which I believe is May 26th or 21st, I forget which one. And it's a very dire situation. The US Holocaust Memorial Museum recently came out and said that they're deeply concerned. And we thought that was it. We thought, my gosh, this is dreadful. You know, there's ways that you can help and reach out. But the awful news from Chechnya just keeps coming and coming. And what we learned earlier this week and last week was that there may now be 6 prisons where gay men are being rounded up and sent to. Mm-hmm. So the initial investigation by the Russian newspaper was that there were 4 prisons where gay men were being caught, arrested, and sent to for interrogation.
Were 2 new internment facilities created, or were 2 new ones discovered?
2 new ones discovered, I believe, at this point. They've realized that, you know, the scope is pretty big. That it's much bigger than just the 4 that they initially thought. So have you been keeping on top of the story as well?
I have been dipping my toes into the water every so often, sort of focusing more on the past week in news kind of retrospectives, mm-hmm. because each individual story tends to be filled with speculation, whereas at the end of the week, when you read the bigger articles, you tend to get a little bit more like, these are the things that have been confirmed that we've pointed out may or may not be true. So I think since we've last spoken, which was last week, I think I've read 2 articles.
Yeah. But we didn't get the conversation on the record last week. Of course, unfortunately, we had to cut that out due to time for the show. But it's very worrying. I mean, the spokespeople for the Russian government and for the Chechen government, they're all claiming nothing to see here, folks.
Yeah.
Nothing happening. Nothing to worry about. What you're saying, totally not happening. It's all false. It's all fake news. Don't you worry about it. But we've now got people talking to the New York Times. Last week we mentioned people talking to HuffPo, people talking to The Guardian, to BuzzFeed, and may not have been BuzzFeed, I think it was actually some other ones. But, you know, different people, all having fled Russia, or from Chechnya into the rest of Russia, talking to Western news agencies, all separately verifying the same thing, saying they were rounded up, tortured, in many cases with electrical torture. So it's a very serious and very worrying position that we find ourselves in.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, the other concerning thing is how slow a lot of the world governments are at commenting about this. There's certain governments that you don't really expect to jump in on it. Like, I'm not really on Spilka's, you know, waiting for the Prime Minister of the Philippines to speak out against it. But when Britain, the United States, Canada, maybe the Netherlands and Germany, they're also huge imports for refugees. When they drag their heels on something, like I don't remember reading an official word from the EU as a collective. Was there a thing?
Oh, I'm sure the EU have. I mean, but they're usually pretty quick, actually, because they usually run with some autonomy. They make decisions quicker than all the member states. But there's something I've just noticed here. So the Minister of the Foreign Office said that...
Minister of the Foreign Office for which country?
For the UK.
Okay.
Said that the UK government had seen Russian language local media in Chechnya, because, of course, it should come as no surprise that, you know, the Russians spy on the West and that the West spy on the Russians.
Yes.
So it should come as no surprise that the UK was watching Western Russian language media, and in which President Kadyrov had made the threat in Russian to see the LGBT community eliminated by Ramadan. So, I mean, which is, I've just seen it now, is the 26th. It's the 26th. Of May. Now, the US have called for Russia to investigate. The UK have called for Russia to investigate. Canada eventually called for Russia to investigate, because we have spoken about the fact that Canada kind of dragged its heels. It's very embarrassing. And I think that Canada can do a lot more.
Well, the official word for a while was actually... I think it was actually... Was it Wasano? I cannot remember.
No, he's the minister for...
Week and a half ago that I read this, was somebody basically said, we're already taking in more LGBT refugees than anyone else in the world, so we're already doing the lion's share. But that's general. That's not really specific to the situation.
Well, I think the issue that you're highlighting here, and I think it's important we talk about, someone had asked the Canadian government, you know, there are hundreds of gay men being rounded up and tortured in Chechnya just for being gay.
Yep.
It's a massive human rights abuse. The Russians are turning into a blind eye. The LGBT charity in Russia are trying to get the Russians to investigate internally and put an end to it, but there's only so much they can do. But in the meantime, these men are being tortured, and there's been allegedly 3 deaths linked to this already.
Mm-hmm.
What can Canada do? Well, most people think, oh, you know, if they're fleeing for their lives, they can be refugees or asylum seekers. Well, Canada has essentially said, if you flee Chechnya into the other bit of Russia, you have not actually left the country.
Yeah.
So...
You're not a refugee yet.
Sorry, not sorry.
Yeah.
You'll have to go a bit further. And that is ridiculous. I mean, I understand it's the current policy, the current position, and maybe they need to take some steps. But I think maybe the Canadian government should be looking into it.
I think if you can make your way to any asylum-granting nation's, what's it called? Embassy. There you go. Or consulate. What's the difference anyway? Doesn't matter. Or maybe it does. Does it matter? No.
A consulate is just a representation of an embassy, but at a remote region, isn't it?
Yeah. It's like a branch.
Okay.
It's like a branch. Like an office, yeah.
Okay, okay. Well, if you can make your way to one of those offices for any asylum-seeking nation, even if they in specific won't take you, I do believe some of them will help you get to another nation that will take you. Like, do they do that? Where if you show up to the UK, they're like, we don't have a policy for this right now, but we have a car, and Canada's down the road. Like, I don't know if they're willing to do that. They might. I mean,
I think in, like, really emergency situations, like if a war is declared in the country and, you know, French people show up at the British embassy, I'm pretty sure the Brits will either send them over to the French embassy or we'll take care of them. Yeah. But it's, in terms of refugees, I don't think you can walk into any embassy and demand to be taken care of. So yeah, I kind of wanted to start off the show with this very serious topic. And I realize it's a bit of a Debbie Downer beginning to the show.
Well, the rest of the show isn't exactly going to be sunshine and rainbows either.
But we do have good news. I have made sure to find some good news. Because it is difficult to me. It is an emotional labor to keep bringing this topic up. I believe that the Canadian government is not doing enough on this. And I hope that if you feel affected by this conversation, that you send a message to your local MP and demand that the Canadian government kind of step up and do more. Or your senators. And speaking of senators, that's a conversation for just after the song. Blondie released a new album.
How is it?
Because, you know, Blondie is a thing that's still a thing.
Oh, yes.
Apparently.
Oh, yes.
It's so. Some of it is dreadfully dreary.
Uh-huh.
But some of it, such as the song Long Time, is kind of upbeat, kind of fun, very sort of Blondie-esque. You're like, oh my god, there's no way that's not Blondie.
Right.
You know? So let us know what you think. This is Blondie's Long Time, and we'll be back after this with hopefully some good news.
Down the Bowery on a crowded afternoon, dripping from the downpour of your
Welcome back to Can Queer Homo Canada's Queer Media. And for folks joining us, that was Blondie with Long Time. Now, you know, it's a challenge. If you're, you know, in the GLBT, LGBTQ2QTA plus
world.
Yeah.
Community.
You know, it's alphabet soup and then some. You know, you kind of want to know, you want to stay on top of what's happening. And there's like Tower Road of QWERTY, and they all kind of do these. I think Tower Road does big stories of the week at the end of the week, the one that you follow.
And they're more likely to be male oriented. There has been that complaint about it. But on the other hand, the staff of Tower Road have all said, we're all gay men.
Yeah.
And so we're going to gravitate towards that.
Well, yeah.
And so, I mean, it's.
PinkNews.co.uk is great for covering global topics. They are the best. They're like the BBC of gay news in terms of they cover the most international news. Actually, I found out that the Equalities Commissioner for Hong Kong has called for greater protections of LGBT people in Hong Kong through PinkNews.co.uk. So that's some good news.
Mm-hmm.
Puts the conversation on the map. But the reason why I bring this up is...
Because I came out in Hong Kong?
You came out in Hong Kong?
You didn't know that about me.
No, I mean, I knew you went to Hong Kong.
Yeah, I lived there.
That's where you came out.
I thought you
came out in Canada.
No, sort of. But yeah, no, I moved to Hong Kong when I was 18. And then when I was there, that was the first time I was openly gay. That was the first time more than two people knew.
Wow.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Wow. And were the two people you and the person you just had sex with?
Well, no.
Oh, then that would change
things.
See,
that would be... Yeah. So, do you agree or disagree that LGBT folks in Hong Kong should...
I mean, when I lived there a year after the handover, so first of all, that dates me a bit. And if you don't know, that was 99. So, 98, 99 is when I lived there. And at that time, it wasn't... dangerous living. It was kind of safe. Like, I never felt unsafe, but there were cultural issues of just... It was sort of the sort of, like, early 90s era relative to North America, where it's like, if you don't talk about it, and if you don't do anything in public, we really don't care. Like, they didn't really bust down doors or anything. Like, it was a safe enough environment. It was just sort of like this awkward, like, oh, I don't know what to do with this kind of information, kind of... phase in queer acceptance. But then the handover happened and Hong Kong became a special administrative region. So it is part of China, but it has a slightly different legal base than the rest of China. And everybody at the time was petrified. And there has been, I actually have been watching, well, not watching the news because I don't really speak Cantonese, but reading news now and then about how Hong Kong has progressed since then. And it's fairly stable as a legal system because China is afraid of losing their incredibly profitable port city.
Yeah.
So generally speaking, it's been slow progress, but it has been way more progress in Hong Kong than the rest of China. And largely because it is an SAR and they do have the right to put their own protections on things. And also this move to secularism, which... In China in general, I mean, mainland and Hong Kong and Taiwan all have sort of a push towards secularism for quite some time now, even though every so often they bring in policies that are very sort of Euro-Christian inspired. And so none of this necessarily alarms me that, you know, the mayor slash governor, because it's an ambiguous position, of Hong Kong is like, you know, I think we could probably do better. I think we could probably do better. And I think that's, I don't know, that just sort of fits in with the general spirit of the city.
So the doing better, I think, really speaks to me in terms of what inspired this investigation by the Equalities Commissioner. And the reason why they were even looking into it is because several charities in Hong Kong kind of raised alarm bells that Hong Kong officials were still recommended as a treatment for vulnerable youth, gay conversion therapy.
Mm.
And they were like, we need to do some urgent protections for LGBT folks, and kind of evening the playing field between LGBT people and straight people in terms of benefits and so on.
Yeah.
The Equalities Commission essentially called gay marriage inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
He said that's the way it's probably going to go. And I think that's kind of good news. I know that there was some other like Asian stories that I'm going to touch on whilst we're in the region. And it makes me think, China introduced vending machines for HIV testing kits.
Ooh,
wow.
Universities.
That's good.
What a great idea, you know? So, in one of the, for folks thinking, vending machines for HIV testing, that sounds like why is that important and a good idea? Now, for folks listening, one of the biggest reasons why HIV infection rates go up is because people don't know their rates. They don't know if they're infected or not. Now, in Canada, if you know you're infected, there is a degree of an obligation to inform your partner, and not to do so puts you in a very gray legal area.
Yeah.
And people have been arrested with administering a noxious substance, which in this case is their semen, for not disclosing. So in Canada, if you know your status, you are kind of obligated, if you're positive, to kind of share it with anyone you're being sexually active with.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes difficult when you're undetectable and so on. But that's an aside. The problem is, if you don't know you're HIV positive and you're having sex with people willy-nilly, all over the place, sex with me, sex with you, sex with all the people, and you're HIV positive, then all the people that you've had sex with are at a very high risk of contracting it. The understanding is that most people are responsible. Most people aren't evil or malicious and out there to cause serious harm. Most people aren't going to do the best to trick you into catching HIV. So if you make it an innocuous thing to get tested, like a general thing, you know, flu shots in the winter kind of idea, where it's just part of your daily, your regular health checkup, then you're far more likely to catch it early on, which puts less people at risk if you're having sex with other people. So it's all in all, it's a very good idea, and it should hopefully reduce infection rates in Chinese universities.
It also prevents the ailment from progressing far enough that you can get a serious infection from it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, between when you get infected and when your HIV is detectable, you do have a compromised immune system, and you could catch something that could affect you for life. It's actually, there's a really astoundingly long list of diseases that can cause blindness and deafness and spine deformation, and you don't want to get hit with one of those.
Oh, hell yeah. I mean, HIV is a big problem. In most Asian countries, from how I grew up in Vietnam, which is quite close to China. So I guess the idea of HIV was a bit more alarming. It's like a myth, but a myth that people believe in. So you can see the problem with HIV and AIDS. I'm not saying it's the same thing, but people usually see this, like, those two together.
Mm-hmm.
So the consequences socially is enormous, but people usually stigmatize it for the same reason. So having a vending machine kind of educate people and destigmatize the problem at the same time. Because HIV infection people think that you have to have sexual contact to get HIV, which is not true. And I mean, obviously science has proved that. And even in universities and young people, no matter how careful you can be, HIV is still, it's vulnerable in many ways through just bloodstream and body contact. That is possible as well. So,
you can't catch HIV through body contact.
No, but let's say you were making out with someone and you have a cut. That increase your your
risk. Yeah, it puts you at risk, but I mean, we don't want to be scammer.
I'm not scammer.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
You know, it takes 6 gallons of saliva to have a reasonable risk of infection. So you can be making out with someone HIV positive all you like, but unless you're drinking 6 gallons of their saliva or pouring 6 gallons into your bloodstream, it's unlikely to happen. But you're right, if someone has cuts inside their mouth or mouth sores and the other person has mouth sores, there may be some blood that mingles through, but only if you keep your mouth closed, because the minute air touches HIV, it dies.
Yeah.
Like, it's a lot weaker than people think, but because people don't get tested, it's able to pass quite easily.
Yeah, it's a numbers game.
But you're right, HIV is very taboo, homosexuality is very taboo, and that's why this program was introduced in 2016. Local media did not pick up on it until last week. So no one talked about it, and that's part of the problem. No one talks about HIV. It's very taboo. You know the product Redline? Like the iPhones and the cars and stuff, like the product Red, and it's the Red charity that goes to supporting So they debranded everything for sale in China. And like they removed all of the associations with HIV/AIDS because of the taboo and the stigma around HIV/AIDS in China. So this idea is to help those folks at those university campuses access that testing, that screening, without having to have extremely awkward conversations with healthcare providers.
Here's a question. So who exactly put these vending machines in?
I believe it was the universities.
I think that's actually a project
taken by the universities.
That's actually a great idea, but because it's so progressive. In Asia in general, you don't see these kind of stories being blasted on like the newspaper or stuff like that. You see these in LGBTQ community newspapers, and you see this in niche blog posts and stuff like that.
Usually what you see is corruption. Southeast Asian media is hyper-vigilant against corrupt politicians. And they catch them often, and they do something about it often. Actually, so does the UK. The UK is pretty good about corrupt politicians, but it has a different level of scandal.
I would say the Southeast Asian, especially, more focus on the political social side of issues, and they foregone the implication of those politicians, of those kind of politics.
Because when you watch like British media and they find a corrupt politician, it's usually about the dollars and cents, about all the money that they wasted. Whereas, at least from what I saw when I lived in Hong Kong and Japan, it was more of a "how dare you," you know, violate the trust of the people kind of a thing.
I don't read a lot of Vietnamese news anymore, but I remember these two instances where I read a Vietnamese piece of news and right after that of news about the Philippines' new president. I think the news article was about him trying to eradicate
rats,
drug dealers.
Oh.
So basically he's encouraging anyone who can identify a drug dealer can use legal force to kill a drug dealer.
Yeah, he's been accused of a mass murder of drug dealers.
But if you look at this news article that I read, which was shared by a Filipino, it's very focused on how this guy is being hyper vigilant against criminals and trying to like straight up the country. That it's a sense that it's unbiased, but at the same time, it's skewed the truth to the perspective of him trying to deal with criminals, but not him trying to kill the criminals.
Yeah, so Duterte, the president of the Philippines, has been accused of personally having shot several people accused of possession and distribution. But the problem is that the police are shooting on sight and there's no judicial process.
Yeah.
And it's becoming almost a war on the poor as opposed to a war on organized crime itself. It's a major issue in the Philippines.
It's basically a purge.
If you want to know why this is a bad thing, just read up why vigilantism is illegal.
Oh, watch The Purge.
Or watch Hitler.
So there's one maybe not so great news story, and this one comes out of Japan, whilst we're still in
Southeast Asia.
So the Japanese have been doing a review. They review their school curricula every now and then, and they've decided
more than now and then. They're really good at it.
And they've decided it'll be too difficult to introduce gender and sexuality into the curriculum. They believe that the public and the guardians have just not accepted, and essentially are saying it's going to be just too much of a hassle to tell people about being homo. Now, there was a study that found that a very large percentage of youth get bullied at schools in Japan as a result.
Oh, yes.
It's a huge issue. And they said that out of a survey of 6,000 teachers, between 63 and 73% thought LGBT issues should be on the curriculum. So how can Japanese authorities saying nobody wants it on the curriculum?
Teachers,
the teachers are saying it should be on the curriculum.
You have to bear in mind that also Japanese public schooling, of everything I've ever seen in my life, is the golden trophy of what socialism ought to look like. Yeah. So to give you an idea, the primary school teachers are encouraged to hold hands and hug the kids, and also there are school lunches that are provided by the state. You don't have to pay into the thing. School lunches give you all of the vitamins and nutrients that you need when you're in puberty. So they actually, when I was there, the other teachers were like, don't eat the school lunches, you will gain weight, because this is designed for a 12-year-old who's about to hit a growth spurt. And sure enough, if you eat half your lunch, you walk away feeling incredibly full and you still gain weight anyway. But anyway, the reason being is the understanding that a lot of children do not have a healthy home life, and that if they don't have a healthy school life, they don't have a healthy childhood at all. And so the public school system actually took it on themselves to give all Japanese children a happy childhood, where they have at least one good meal a day. Most of them, like, going home and not eating for the rest of the day is not a very Japanese experience. It can happen, but it's much more of an American story. But it's more about, like, the quality of the food that you're eating. And the second thing is the quality of the socialization you're getting, that you are expected to have a happy childhood. And I even remember there was one day I showed up to a school and they had canceled the class because one of the students' aunt was in hospital and the whole class was going to go visit her. Just canceled the day of class to visit this lady. And it was basically just sort of reinforcing community and in support of the child. And when I spoke to the teacher, she was like, we're a week ahead on lessons. We can spare the time. It's not a big deal. This is more important. It was really interesting. So this kind of thing, like, the teachers are genuinely invested in their students' happiness. And also, on the flip side, because of bullying, which does exist, and teachers have a limited ability to do anything about it, in the sense that adults have a limited ability to do anything for any child, really. Mm-hmm. It's not even about that. About once a year, it's almost an annual event, sometimes twice in a year, you hear about some, usually a 14-year-old girl, who got bullied to the point where she just couldn't take it anymore, and she takes either an X-Acto knife or a box cutter and just slices up two of her classmates. And sometimes they also end their own lives. Sometimes they run into the woods. It's really complicated. And when it happens, the teachers don't blame the girl because they know what she's been through. Mm-hmm. They also acknowledge that she did something very bad and she needs to go to juvie. But, you know, they also understand that this is the kind of thing that happens. And it's just, it's a very compassionate culture, at least in public school.
Yeah.
The corporate culture has been studied extensively for being cold, but this is a different issue.
I think it's worth highlighting, this is one of the things I like about pinknews.co.uk, is that they link other relevant stories. So at the end of the article, it also mentions that they elected their first trans man to public office at a councillor in the city of Urama, and Sapporo recently legalized same-sex marriage in the city, or same-sex unions. And they in Japan, Osaka recognized fostering for same-sex couples. Hmm. So, I mean, the cities seem to be moving ahead.
Yeah.
But it looks like maybe the federal education is falling a little bit behind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, lived in Vietnam, is there a difference between what happens at the city level and what happens from kind of federally led institutions?
Well, first of all, I would like to acknowledge Sebastian's point earlier, as he said that the Japanese have a really strong form of socialization in their public school and their culture.
Yeah.
And I seriously appreciate that. And it actually doesn't surprise me.
You can actually see echoes of it if you watch anime. Any public school themed anime, they will touch on that.
Like, if you are into the Japanese culture, you would notice that Japanese schools have very strong idea of independency, but at the same dependency on each other, like they take care of their own. Like, they really do take care of their own. Like, if you're in one class,
that class stay together. Like, it's just
or
kind
they
of,
try to.
All the it's like kind of like a tribal kind of idea that they. I don't think I heard a myth where Japanese school don't hire janitors and they kind of train their students to do like housework and stuff.
Oh, that's not a myth. That's policy.
Which is I just want to confirm it. But
it has to do with the fact that when you clean the space you're in, you become more protective of it. There's no vandalism. Mm-hmm. Vandalism is incredibly rare in Japanese schools because if anybody vandalizes anything, it's going to be their friends who have to clean it up.
Yeah.
So
I think that idea of Japanese kind of taking care of their own and kind of understanding the limits and the emotional stability of each other, it makes them more sensitive to, sexuality and gender identities and all that sort. That makes it a little bit easier for them to see, like the teacher to see the necessities of having LGBTQ.
It's kind of like country living. I don't know. Like they touched on this briefly in Letterkenny, mm-hmm. if you remember this. There was the one character who is obviously a gay man, but is closeted, but everybody just knows he's a gay man.
Yep. But they don't say the priest.
Yeah. And he gets into trouble at one point in time. And at one point they're like, you know, he's annoying and he's a weirdo, but he's our weirdo. And that's very much like that's
very Japanese.
Yeah.
Like they really take care of their own and they acknowledge like each other individually. So I feel like as a Vietnamese, I don't feel the same way. Unfortunately, because
every culture tries to strike a balance between individualism and collectivism. Every country is somewhere in the middle. It's just some go more one way and more the other.
The Japanese do it so well.
Well, in public school, they do.
we're gonna jump to the last quick tidbit of Southeast Asian news before we jump to a song.
Something from Korea that would round off the tour.
No, we're going back to China.
Okay,
I'm sorry, and it's I'm doing this because it's kind of funny. So in China, the gay community sort of co-opted the term comrade,
yeah.
as or the Chinese equivalent of the term comrade, as a way of kind of identifying each other as through a moniker. Well, now the President Xi is kind of upset that he can't call his comrade without gay connotations. Mm-hmm. So he's reclaiming the word from the homos and trying to reclaim the communist comrade from gay men, which I just think is hilarious that the communists are threatened by gay men and the use of the word comrade. We're going to play a song called Mood by Emily Vaughan. It's nice on that beat. Should help lift the spirits of the conversation. Emily Vaughan is out of Florida. Mm-hmm. And we'll be wrapping up later with Ria May, who is Canadian. But that is all for now. When we get back, a Canadian story and a bit of a conversation around hate crimes. What Canada is doing, what Canada's going to do, and maybe what Canada can do some to improve looking at other examples around the world. But that's all for now, and we'll be back just after this.
What about goodbye? Do you not understand? What about me moving on makes you think you can't? I don't wanna hear another word out your mouth. I'm sick of listening, what you're bitching about. I'm not in the mood. I'm not in the mood. I don't care if I make you stop and stare. If you question who I am, who I am, I'm so gone. There's no need to prove me wrong. I don't care what you do, no matter what you do. I'm not in the mood. I'm not in the mood.
Hello and welcome back to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith and I'm joined by
Jake here.
I'm Sebastian.
And we're going to be bringing it back to Canada, people. Back to Canada, because as much as I love Southeast Asia. So on Thursday, April the 27th, there was a incident in Nanaimo, BC, which for folks listening is kind of across the river from Vancouver. So on the island with Victoria, which is Vancouver Island, but it's kind of across from Vancouver.
It's Canada's westernmost major city.
Nanaimo?
Yeah. Oh. I think it's a little bit further west than Victoria, just because the island slants a bit.
But I think they also make delicious little dessert things.
No. The person who invented the Nanaimo bar is from Nanaimo.
Oh.
But it was first invented in a baking competition that took place in Ontario.
Oh, the travesty. Oh, you know, because I'm going to visit Nanaimo, and I was so excited to go to the home place
honestly,
of Nanaimo bars.
If you go there, they'll probably parade it around, but go there for the seafood. They have really good seafood on the West Coast.
Okay. Well, good to know. Anyway, what's...
And walk on the beach. They have these crazy algae that when you step on them, they explode.
Oh, okay.
And they make these cool popping noises. And at first, I was like, I feel really bad for stepping on all these algae. But then, like, there's a guide there, and they're like, no, the little pods are filled with plant semen, and so you're actually helping them reproduce.
And your shoes are covered in plant semen.
So yeah, okay. Yeah. Jake is making a face. So aquatic animals have pollen with tails, so they actually have semen. So like algae will release pollen with tails, i.e. plant semen, into the water.
You know why this is kind of grossing me out? Because I went diving once. And I...
You're covered in fish sperm. You know that.
Yeah. Right? Pretty much. Yeah. I jumped down into an algae type thing to watch the corals. And now that you say that, basically I just jumped into an algae orgy.
Yeah.
Or bukkake. Yeah. If you don't know what that is, Google it.
Actually, don't Google that.
Yeah. Well, it's up to you.
Safe search on.
To risk.
If you do safe search on.
Oxford Dictionary search that.
The literal translation of bukkake is a spill. So if you knock your coffee mug over, then you just bukkake the table.
I will khaki at the table a lot. I will khaki every day.
You're really into this, aren't you?
I just find it hilarious that I'm like, oh gosh.
Of course it has a literal meaning.
I khakied my spaghetti all over the front of my trousers.
Dear audience, you just learn a new word. Use it.
There are very few...
That one's tickled me pink, that
words
one.
That don't also mean something else when it comes to sex.
If you're listening to this, use that word today in casual conversation and see if people
spill
notice.
Spill something, say you've bukkakeed, that is just...
I'm pretty sure I used the word spilkas earlier as well. Which is Yiddish for pins and needles. Anyway.
So back to Nanaimo. The RCMP responded to a call by a businessman who'd hooked up with somebody, went to a hotel, and then was beaten up and robbed.
Right.
So a bit of a honey trap situation. Now, we here at Cancria and previously with the Velvet Studio keep telling folks, please be very, very safe and secure. And we've done countless episodes trying to promote a greater sense of safety on hookup apps.
Yeah.
Because in Australia, there was a string of, I think, there was a serial killer who got to 20 or 30 gay men.
Yeah.
Through it. In the UK and in the US, we've had extortion, sextortion, kidnappings.
New York City
robbings.
Had a string of break and enters where the honeypot let them in through the front door.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
So, please be careful. RCMP are treating this as a hate crime. Now, I believe that it is a misnomer. So, for folks listening and thinking, how can they be treating this mugging as a hate crime? Quick 101 of hate crimes in Canada.
Or just legal system in general.
Yeah. So there's almost no such thing as a hate crime. The only hate crime is promoting genocide and calling for the mass murder of an identifiable group.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a hate crime. So distributing pamphlets calling for the murder of all gays would be a hate crime.
Right.
Now, if I punch somebody in the face, that's assault. But if I punch somebody in the face because they're gay, then not only would the person who was punched in the face be upset by that, but other gay people would be thinking, my gosh, there's a crazy person punching gay people in the face. Maybe I shouldn't go out at night. So it has that broader community impact when it's because they were gay.
Right.
So that's why this is a hate crime.
Right.
A hate crime in this sense is when you've been prosecuted for a crime, which would be punching someone in the face.
Assault or mischief or
in
something.
In Nanaimo, robbing a person blind, and I think there was some assault. There was injuries, and he was taken to hospital. So that's the crime. But the fact that it has impacted the broader community makes it a hate crime or a hate-motivated crime.
Mm-hmm.
So just a little free 101 spiel for the folks listening.
Most hate crimes in Canada are actually just the motivation of another crime.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And as of probably the next 2 to 10 months, because it's still in the books, but everybody's on board, mm-hmm. Mischief, which is damaging someone's property. So it could be graffiti, it could be just destroying something, it could be rendering something unusable.
Yeah.
On purpose is the legal definition of mischief in Canada. So mischief, currently, as it now stands, cannot get a hate crime label attached to it, but it will probably by the end of the year. So if somebody graffitis your front door, they get the graffiti, they also get mischief. Well, the graffiti is mischief, and then they could also get hate crime if they do like homophobic yeah. slurs or something.
So the federal government in Canada has introduced for the first time. So let's backpedal a bit here. So if you deface a mosque, or you put anti-Christian slurs on a church, or you put really racist things on places where people of color gather, you know, they are protected, and there's actually funds available. So if you want to put a security system around your mosque to stop it being graffitied or defaced,
yeah.
You know, there's a fund available for that. But for the first time ever, they've opened that fund up to LGBTQ spaces and kind of cultural institutions, which I think is great.
Mm-hmm.
If it wasn't for the fact that so many of them no longer kind of exist,
right?
It's a struggle. Like, I can only think of like the 519 in Toronto, and I think there's one in Davie Village in Vancouver. But you know, there's specifically queer spaces are few and far between.
Community centers with extensive LGBT programming can also qualify, I believe. Mm-hmm. So from what I read, I didn't get into the fine print, because fine print on grants is, you need a very special kind of brain to be able to read the fine print on a grant. But anyway, the general idea was that if you have any space even set aside, so if you have a youth center and your youth center is large enough to have multiple spaces and one of those spaces is guaranteed for LGBT and gender nonconforming youth, then you can put, you know, you can pay to get a wall knocked out to get a second door put in, because you need that escape door quite often. Mm-hmm. Or fire escape, or whatever. Like, you can get that extra stuff
done. Like CCTV cameras, yeah. Or yeah, yeah.
Or a lock on the door that actually works.
Mm-hmm. So I think this is great. I think it's maybe 10, 20 years too late, which is unfortunate. But the other part of it is to kind of reemphasize that the Canadian government is taking hate crimes seriously.
Yes.
I believe if that translated into the various police services taking hate crime seriously, we'll see a boon. And I'm glad you defined mischief earlier, because in Ottawa, one of the most recent cases of a hate crime was when a trans mural that was placed in along a city street by the city
right.
was defaced with anti-trans rhetoric. You know, the Ottawa Police Hate Crimes Unit said, it's mischief on mischief, nothing we can do about it.
Yeah.
Which does nothing for community trust and policing. It completely undermined.
And strictly speaking, it's the way that the police are like, the police are not supposed to interpret the law. They're told, you do this, they do that thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, on the one hand, it would have been great if they actually looked into it. But on the other hand, it could easily go the other way. You could be looking at like a situation like in the 60s or 70s where they'd be slapping trumped up charges on people saying, yeah. Well, like, you looked at me in a funny way, so that's resisting arrest, so clearly I can beat you up now.
Because that does not happen.
Right. And so the sort of stripping them of their ability to interpret things is...
Well, the problem is that we believed at the time that they misinterpreted. They said it was graffiti on graffiti, but it was a mural that was put there by the city.
Right.
But it hadn't yet been deemed public property. It was kind of private property that the city had taken charge of. And then it was graffitied. So they just turned a blind eye. And I think the problem then is that they've lost a lot of confidence. But I hope, and I hope beyond hope beyond hope, that other police services will take this thing seriously. It also doesn't help that anti-trans crime is not protected under the Human Rights, the Federal Human Rights Act or the Criminal Code.
Yeah.
Right now, if you beat somebody up because they are trans, You might face some trouble in civil courts, but legally speaking, there's no additional...
Well, I mean, if you committed assault, you get hit with assault.
Yeah, but you won't face that additional hate crimes things because trans folks aren't on a protected grounds.
And they may not look into it to see if it's a greater pattern, to mm-hmm. see if there's, you know, if there's previous cases with the same perpetrator, that sort of thing.
So Bill C-16, which is this government's latest iteration of essentially putting gender identity, gender expression into the Criminal Code and Human Rights Act, so that if you do get anti-trans graffiti, if trans folks do get beaten up and abused, that they're offered the same protection of other at-risk groups. It's about kind of leveling the playing field here. That is actually at the Senate next week. Can Queer, in the shape of myself, will be there. So we'll be giving you folks a bit of an update. We're a little worried because some of the senators have brought on some rather hostile speakers, mm-hmm. which makes me think, actually, and we were having this conversation earlier, Jake, which makes me think of the Heineken ad. Now, you saw this a bit of the Pepsi ad where this protest for peace and love...
Generic, non-specific.
The Abercrombie and Finch model cast call protest for peace and love.
Where everyone is smiling.
Yeah, because they're just really happy to work for Abercrombie and Finch, obviously. And they show up and any tension is relieved by just a perfectly placed can of Pepsi handed over to an equally beautiful police person opposite, which everyone called foul on. Like, that's just ridiculous.
Yep.
You know, the protests are ugly, sweaty businesses with purpose, not a commercial branding opportunity. Anyway, back to the reason why I brought up Budweiser. Was it Budweiser?
Heineken,
sorry. Heineken did an ad, and they've been told that they did the Pepsi ad the right way around, where it's two people show up and they start like building furniture and they don't know anything about each other and they start like doing teamwork things, just two people. But we learn at the start that these two people have really opposite views. Like someone's like, we need to do more for climate change. And the other person's like, climate change is a lie.
Mm.
We should be focusing on like poverty issues. And then they get them to build a thing and then they play a video of each other's statement. And they're like, you can talk about it or drink a Heineken and have a conversation. Or you can leave or drink a Heineken and have a conversation. Which is interesting. It makes it look like Heineken's the solution to all problems.
I mean, the way I see it, Pepsi did one thing wrong, is that they had a bunch of marketing people sit in a boardroom and say, what's the most popular topic they could get and get the most views? And they did. But then what Heineken did better was that they gave it context. So the ad itself did kind of give a lot of context of between two platforms, two opposite ideas, you know, like no climate change doesn't exist, and climate change, trans person should not be existing. That kind of idea. But at the same time, it kind of legitimate that there is no climate change and there is an idea that there is climate change. So mm-hmm. they kind of drop the ball in the sense that they open up all this conversation about differences, and then they drop it where people drink in Heineken, and that solves the problem.
Yeah.
Because that's not how you solve a problem. If I drink any Heineken, that solves my problem.
I mean, conversation does solve a lot of problems.
It does. The ad presented the idea, and we bring it up because there's a trans woman and a man who's like, you know, this man is man and woman's woman, and that's it, and that's the way it is. And then they have a conversation, and then they're best buds at the end of the commercial. But it kind of, what it does, it says, you know what? Yeah, we're a beer company, and there are two sides to the conversation. Let's have a conversation, you know?
It's kind of the way that they kind of soften the blow towards the other side, as like they're trying to say that there is a conversation going on, as there should be a conversation going on. But the problem is, they go too far and made, you know, opinions almost like it's a platform that should mm-hmm. be discovered, but it's not. It's like science already proven that, you know, there is climate change. Climate change is happening. You can't deny it. Trans people are there. You cannot say that, you know, they want to be. And I think one particular point to make out is that part at the end where the trans woman and the guy who has the idea that trans woman should not exist, he asked for her phone number and then kind of exchanged very generic, like, you know, like pleasantries, and I felt really awkward
mm-hmm.
because at the beginning And when they view each other's statements, these two look incredibly uncomfortable. One, like, the guy was really, really aggressive, and the trans woman was, you know, really honest. And, you know, at that point where they found out each other's statement, it's kind of a clash of reality, and they don't know how to react. But then the Heineken ad ended on a good note, but then what's after that good note of conversation?
And I bring this up, and it's probably the last thing we'll get to talk about today, because... And I bring this up because we have the Senate committee hearings, and they're bringing in all of these speakers, and they're having a conversation really with it posed as, you know, there's lots of people, lots of opinions on this. Let's hear everybody talk. But I think, let's look at it this way. There are Canadians who can get beaten up just for being trans and not have the same protections as women, as black people, as Muslims, as gay people, because we don't think they're equitable to those other at-risk group. That is a fact. That's not an opinion, you know? And I think that we shouldn't be equating the anti-trans position to a pro-trans position, because I think it's a false equation.
The major difference between trans issues and a lot of the other issues is that the anti-trans camp denies that they exist. That's one of the big things. Like, you can have people disagreeing on drug policy, but no one's denying that drugs exist. And I think that's one of the major issues. So if you look at countries in the world where you can face jail time or capital punishment just for being gay, I think it's 73 nations in the world. All 73 of those ones will punish men. I think only 4 of them will punish women. And then there's like 2 or something that will punish trans people. But the problem is you need to be progressive enough to acknowledge that they exist in order to make laws against them. And so the abuse is not necessarily a legal systemic one, but rather one of systemic neglect. And so, you know, you can't apply for a job because you don't exist. You can't get healthcare because you don't exist. And so it's a completely different kind of conversation, where the main one here is, do you exist? Yes or no? And acknowledging that they exist, you need to be at least a certain kind of liberal or progressive society to even acknowledge that they exist enough to be able to make a law about them.
Mm-hmm. See, the problem I see with that is that, yes, you're absolutely right, but the corporatization of this product, because if you think about it, where does this ad like broadcast? It's broadcast on the internet in like developed countries where people have their own opinions and have their like other sources of media. So they don't need to tell like people to tell you or an ad to tell you that these things exist. Everyone tell them that these things exist or don't exist already. So these ads are basically just attacking people, or at least like attracting people's sense of social liberties and, you know, those kind of social class heroes that people think that, you know, by adopting or praising these ads or being progressive, they themselves are progressive, but they have to think of the implication of these ads are not, it's not battling anything. These ads are ads using topics of social issues to sell you things.
Yeah, they really are.
I think, although I have a lot of issues with like corporatizing dialogues, unfortunately, that is all we've got time for today. Next week, we will be talking about C16 and how that is going, amongst some other topics. We are playing out with Ria May's girlfriend, and that's all for now. If you think that we are wrong, or I am wrong, on my position on the Heineken ad, tweet us at VelvetStudio1 and find us on Facebook, TalkCanQueer, because I totally plugged the wrong Twitter there, but whatever. Reach out to us, and we'll be happy to have you in the conversation. That's all for now.
I've been Nick Smith. Hashtag Bukkake.
Hashtag Bukkake is not the hashtag we're going to run with.
Okay, fine.
Anyways, I've been Luke Smith.
Jake.
I'm Sebastian.